I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives.
Correct. Oh, we started now. Yes.
Yes, of course we've started.
I'd been working at the Playbox Theatre, and I'd worked as an ASM on a show, a Louis Nowra show, The Golden Age.
The golden years of Hollywood. That was what I loved.
Absolutely don't profess to be good at it at all. I could study and I could be much more diligent in my homework.
So in a sense, you know, I think really good directors are really good editors.
I was really incapable of going on, not just as a writer, but I felt as if I was incapable of going on as a human.
One more day before the storm. And Trevor says, stop, stop. He said, you look like little Lord Fauntleroy, dip the wig.
So I swooped in and just... Every scene I had with all those different people, they just made it work.
But after some time, I realised that grey comes in many, many hues.
I've had the luck, and without the luck, I know plenty of entertainers out there that are wonderful, funny, just never had the breaks.
I'm what I would call a dancer's dancer. Like, all I ever wanted to do was dance.
You've got a better memory than me, that's for sure.
Oh, I've done my research. I've cheated.
And you'd had a little piece of paper there, mind you, so have I. Yeah,
we both had pieces of paper, so that's been
alright. I wasn't
right.
Silly, was I?
No, I think it was great. Yeah. Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you, Peter. God bless.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers. It's always a sad occasion when Stages reposts a Valet episode, especially when it's a someone who I was privileged to call a friend. On January 14th, we learned of the passing of theatre impresario Martin McCallum. He was a featured guest on the Stages podcast in January of 2019. The podcast was only a year old, but Martin, with his enthusiasm and vigour for supporting new ventures, was keen at my first suggestion. I am so honoured that we were able to record some of his story in this episode. Martin resided in Australia for the past 20 years. He was brought here originally when he was overseeing the transfer of global hit musicals such as Evita to Australian shores, working alongside the Adelaide Festival Centre Trust. The relationships he established in Australia would enable him to successfully bring Cameron McIntosh's four juggernaut musicals to our theatres in the 80s and 90s. Cats, Les Miserables, The Phantom of the Opera and Miss Saigon. Martin guided McIntosh's overseas production ventures and managed Australian and New York offices. He worked closely with McIntosh on restoring the Prince Edward and Prince of Wales theatres in London's West End. He commenced his life in the theatre as a stage manager and bit part actor in regional repertory theatre in the UK, working his way up the ranks to joining Laurence Olivier and the National Theatre at the Old Vic in 1971. Adept at all technical elements of the theatre and proving himself as an accomplished manager, Martin oversaw the practical and technical transfer of the National to the South Bank building in 1976. He was indeed a giant and gentleman of the theatre, and a lovely bloke and treasured friend to many of us. Valet Martin McCallum.
Yeah, well, and only now are the government beginning to realise that imagination and creativity are actually the keys to a healthy business community. You know, because all of that is all about self-expression.
Yeah.
And that might be doing physics.
Yes.
You know, but it's about understanding.
The STEM subjects aren't going to work unless you've got that creative
approach.
Well,
it should be STEAM.
yes, put the arts in there as well.
Is what the argument has been, that STEM should be changing to STEAM. And, I'm all for that. And, you know, as dear old Pierre Rickman said, you know, culture and creativity are the way man really explores his humanity. And that is unique. You know, no other creature has culture in that way.
You went to an arts-centred school with Frensham Heights?
Well, yes, it would have. It was called Progressive in those days, and I think if my father had realised, he would never have sent me there. I think he thought he was sending me just to a public school and giving me an education that he didn't have. Well, I was averse to academic work. I didn't think I was bright enough, actually, to be really honest. I didn't think I was very good at that, and I didn't understand the academic world because I couldn't relate it to reality. And every time I asked a question, I was told to just shut up and learn it. And I could only learn things that I could understand and give context to. So I ended up gravitating to sport, and I became a huge sports person. And through that, I ended up doing modern dance under a lady called Vivian Soldan, who was Jacques Dalcroze's, one of her star pupils.
Right.
So that was a very happy accident. And that led me into performing at school. And so when I left school, I had no idea what I was going to do. And I was quite intimidated by the thought. I was sent off for a sort of assessment in London. I remember sent off to this grey building in Welbeck Street, which I often walk past since, and was assessed. And basically, it's like an IQ test. And I just knew that I had a way of expressing myself, but I had no doorway through which I could go to do that. And so when I left school, I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to go off and play sport. I had been offered a place at university, believe it or not, if I got my A-levels, to play hockey, because I was very good at hockey. But anyway, I went off to do a technical college course in, believe it or not, French, German and business studies, which I hated. And I only liked the French and German because it was a bit like acting, talking foreign languages. I was at college and I got invited into this club to do a film for the BBC, which was a competition they used to run in those days for amateur films, and ended up getting quite a good part in it. And I suddenly thought, well, if I'm doing all this, I should learn a bit more about the theatre, really. And by coincidence, I met somebody who said, I know somebody who works at a local theatre. So to cut a long story short, I ended up working in the theatre at weekends. It was the end of weekly rep. And so I was there every weekend helping change the sets around and get stuff ready. And then bleary-eyed on a Monday morning, I would trudge back to college. And after I'd done this for about a year or so, I was asked if I'd like a job. And I said, oh, what does that mean? I said, well, we give you a full-time job here. I said, that's fantastic. We'll call you a student ASM. We'll give you £1 a week. And I said, excuse me, £1 a week? But you give me £3 a week at the weekends.
Working as a casual?
They said, yes, but casual labour is very expensive. And that was my induction to the business world of negotiating in the theatre. Anyway, I accepted it, and that was really the beginning of my journey. I suddenly felt I was at home.
You had to tell your parents then, didn't you? Because you'd been moonlighting, really.
Yes, I had. Yeah. I didn't. My mother knew, but I didn't tell my father. And in fact, when my father found out, he didn't speak to me for about 18 months.
Through disappointment, or?
Yeah. Well, he felt my parents were pretty poor. They were, you know. They sold fruit and veg, and had spent any money they had on sending me off to an education, and my father felt that I'd thrown that back in his face. And you also have to remember, in those days, people who worked in the theatre were really considered outside of society.
Mm.
They were, you know, ne'er-do-wells, as my father would say, and they led very dubious lives. Yeah, it was a very different world then. My parents came from a generation, having gone through the war and lost, you know, what little they had, and struggling to make a living after the war, had, you know, realised that to have the security of a job was the most important thing, whatever it was, whereas the last thing I wanted was security. I wanted to get out in the world and try and work out why I was in it. What was I here for? And I was really very lucky. I worked for a lady who was the stage director in that company, who had been there for quite a long time. Joan Knight was there before, who was very well known in repertory theatre in those days. She was one of the stars. And a lady called Caroline Smith took over. And then this stage director had transitioned through that period. And she really gave me my values in the theatre. And I realised that I'd found a family, in a way, that I hadn't had before. And that was very special to me. And also it was a world in those days where you were basically a jack of all trades. You did everything. You know, you'd be building sets, painting props, reupholstering.
Because the training institutions at the time were perhaps only for actors, really. They went for the technical roles in theatre.
Yeah, there was no obvious mainstream training for that, certainly in the early 60s. I mean, the drama school was there, and I remember thinking, I'm doing this until I can go to drama school. But once I got into it, I thought, there's no way I can really go to drama school now.
We were serving an apprenticeship.
I did. Mm. And I enjoyed other aspects aside from learning to be a young actor, you know, and you do all sorts of things. I mean, I can remember playing small parts where you'd run off and you'd be the one free to operate the lighting board, so you do the next lighting cue. And then, you know, maybe set a couple of props. So it was, it was an amazing induction. And as I say, it was a family because you were together, you know, up to 15 hours a day, seven days a week.
Explain to us what the English Repertory Theatre system was. How did that work?
Well, it was a series of local theatres throughout the region, some larger than others, that were the mainstay of employment for the acting community, because in those days, television was still in its infancy. You know, I started working in the theatre in 65, 66. I got my first full-time £1 a week job in September 67. So yes, I'm celebrating my 50 years.
Congratulations.
And those actors that came round, you know, I mean, June Brown, Miriam Carlin, Harold Lang, you know, there was a whole range of people that then appeared on our television sets or on movies in the following 10 years. I mean, Miriam Carlin became a huge star on British television.
Well, the television film, they were looking for talent to sort of, that they could use on screen.
Yeah, yeah, but where was the talent? No. It was all working in the British repertory system, playing Pitlochry in the summer. Some amazing artists that would go to Pitlochry. And then, of course, Olivier had Chichester, which was the forerunner of the National Theatre. And, you know, other artists, you know, Gielgud and Ralph Richardson would be playing seasons in the West End, with Binky Beaumont being, you know, the impresario, among many others, of course, but Binky was probably the most well-known at that time. And so that's where everybody worked. And everybody worked on, you know, as you can see, relatively very low wages. But that's what people wanted to do. And that network of repertory company, I mean, it must have been in its 50s and 60s of theatres around the country. And it didn't really get scythed until the early 70s. And then the whole system began to fall apart, partly because of funding, because of the costs and the change of living standards, union regulations. I mean, when I first worked in rep, you did anything. By the time that you got to the end of the 60s, it was so unionised that, you know, acting ASMs weren't allowed to do anything technical. It started, and it wasn't an aggressive thing, but it was seen as a modernisation and a protection. But sadly, it removed an understanding for people, because when you work across disciplines, you understand things, certainly as an actor, that you would never understand if all you did was act. You learn what other people had to go through and the difficulties they had to face in basically servicing your performance. And I thought that was a really healthy thing to do. And it certainly was very valuable to me because it showed me so many different careers I could have in the theatre from, you know, a purely creative side. And I ended up doing lighting design and sound design after being a stage manager and a bad actor for a number of years.
Well, theatre is so much about the collaborative experience, isn't it? There's so many disparate parts. So that I think if you do have an experience or an appreciation of all of those, it can only make you a better practitioner in whatever field you've chosen.
Absolutely. It also did something else to the young actor, because all of these companies were established often with people who would go back year after year. There would be a number of changes and new people introduced, but, you know, the core of the company might go back and play a season in that company every year. And so cross-casting was a real art form to get this group of people who had to be able to play all the parts in all of the disparate plays. Now, what that tended to do with younger actors who were not the leading actors, there would be leading actors who would come in for a season and maybe do two or three plays out of the 7 or 8 or 10 that you might do, depending on how many weeks you ran a show for. Well, as a young actor, you would often get cast in a role that you weren't really quite suited for. But what it did was stretch you. And you were often playing parts above your age range or beyond your natural characteristics. That really made you think about how to make this believable. And that was a fantastic grounding for young actors doing more than they should have done. I left the repertory system, and after being a lighting designer and a sound designer, such as that was in those days, that meant that you were basically the technician, but you happened to light the shows.
And you hung the lights.
Yeah. And in the West End, those shows were still lit or relit by the stage manager, who didn't have teams. You know, when I first started doing shows, you know, you'd have people like Joe Davis, who was the lighting designer, who would have a technician assistant with him. But when that show moved, if it was on tour before it came into the West End, it would have been relit by the stage manager at each venue. And only when it came into the West End would Joe come in and look at it again and make sure it was, you know, presentable for a West End audience. There was no history of technical departments. The production manager did not exist in those days. You had a stage director in rep, depending on how big the theatre was, and, you know, whether they were building their own scenery in quite sophisticated circumstances.
So I imagine it would be quite easy then at that time for shows to get out of hand, performances or things to go wrong, if there wasn't a caretaking team on site ensuring that the original vision was maintained.
Well, it found a level, you know, that was custom and practice. It wasn't abnormal. That was the way things tended to happen. And you relied very much on the offices of the company manager and the stage manager in commercial situations. But when I started to do commercial shows as a producer, I was very keen to bring what I'd done with the production office as a central part of how you approach putting a show together, which was giving as much respect to the design and technical department as one gave to the company in the directorial department. And that, I think, had quite an impact on the way shows were looked after and the way companies felt that they were considered.
Great. Let's jump back to, at age 21, you scored quite a big job at the beginning of quite what was to be a juggernaut enterprise at the National.
Yes, I was very fortunate. I was happily lighting shows and running around in Manchester, and I got a message asking me if I would like to go for an interview to the Old Vic for assistant production manager.
So this is because somebody had heard about you, or you were doing a good job?
What had happened was that I had, through an old family friend who was actually a very important person in the theatre historically, through Sadler's Wells, and with the man who actually was the reason, and everybody forgets this, but the reason the National Theatre really happened in the end was a man called Stephen Arlen, who ran Sadler's Wells Opera and Ballet. And that became English National Opera, what we know as English National Opera now. And a lady there was a family member, not by blood, but through marriage. And she'd been asked to talk to me to get me out of going to into the theatre by my father, who had been desperate. We're going back years now when I was, you know, 16, 17 years old. And she had suggested that maybe I go for an interview to their production department. And in those days, there were only four or five companies, the national companies, that had production management departments: the National, the RSC, the Royal Opera, Sadler's Wells, or English National Opera, as it was. And I went along and, did this sort of test, was given all sorts of questions about how you would face this issue or that issue. But I was clearly far too young. I was, 20 years old, I think, 19, 20 years old. And I didn't get the job, but I had a great day in London, which was a treat in those days, locked away in, whatever city you were working in. And sometime later, it must have been 8 or 9 months later, I got this message. And what had happened was that the national companies used to talk to each other, and the old Vic had obviously said, "We need somebody." And the guy said, "Well, this guy would be perfect. He wasn't really experienced enough for us, but as an assistant, he might be quite interesting." So that's how the interview happened. And then I got the job. I didn't quite realize what I was stepping into. I didn't know a huge amount about Olivier. I hadn't studied. I just knocked about in the theater.
Had you seen much of Olivier on screen?
No.
No, right, nothing.
I mean, going to the cinema was still a bit of a luxury.
Right.
I'd go to the Saturday morning kids thing, and I mean, that wasn't something I did. I was either out playing sport or I was suddenly working full-time in a theatre and you didn't see anything. Anyway, I bundled up. I remember I arrived on those shows at the National in those days. You did three production weekends before every show opened. And I arrived for the first production weekend of Coriolanus. And that was quite extraordinary. I found out afterwards it was supposed to have been starring Chris Plummer, and Tony Hopkins took over. Chris Plummer, it was being done with the Berliner Ensemble, Manfred Weckwerth, and they thought that they were doing the Shakespearean Coriolanus, and they weren't.
Right.
They were doing Brecht. Plummer was beside himself. Anyway, I was thrown into this incredibly dynamic and grown-up situation, very sophisticated to my eyes, huge technical departments, very complex scheduling and programming. And remember, this was not repertory, this was repertoire. So you might have three different productions playing in a week with enormous changeovers overnight, quite significant physical productions, complex lighting rigs. It was the time to be a stagehand, and they, worked hours and hours and earned huge amounts of money. So I was dropped into this,
Was unionisation playing a part then?
Yes. It actually became the reason I left the National Theatre, funnily enough. But there was a house agreement there. There was no, it was very early days for any of this kind of stuff. But a house agreement had been negotiated with NACI, which was the union as it was in those days. And it was pretty tough. If you didn't get breaks, you could have people working on triple time for days afterwards until they got an 18-hour break, just because they'd had an inky lunch 4 days before or something.
Right.
So it could all escalate and get very out of hand. Anyway, it was a very exciting time and I learned a huge amount. But then suddenly, within 13 months, I got my notice because the National was in huge debt. And there was a crisis and people were being fired left, right and centre.
Was Peter Hall running it?
No, it was Olivier.
It's Olivier, right.
and I had to go. And that was, it was awful, really, because I was having such a good time. I was very lucky. I did all of Olivier's shows. I took over Merchant of Venice and took him on tour as soon as I got there. And I then went in, somebody who was working on Amphitryon, which he was directing, had a bit of a crack up. And so I was sent out to take over the show in Oxford. That was Chris Plummer and Geraldine McEwen and Olivier directing. And that's, I guess, where our bond came, because I was so green. I had no idea. I should have been terrified. I just marched in. I remember David Hersey was trying to light the back of this set, which looked like the Pearl and Dean advertisement on the cinema we used to have in those days, these huge Greek temples of the gods in white. And they were made of this plastic that if you touched it, it just left fingerprints over it, or it dented, or it tore. And we had three lots of them, a yellow set, a pink set, and a blue set for each act. And David Hersey was up at the back trying to light this psych, and he'd heard that I was coming over. And I remember him turning around to me and saying, "You're a lighting designer, you light this fucking psych," and stormed off. And I don't think I went to bed whilst I was in Oxford, not for the first 7 or 8 days. I used to send carpenters back there to go and have a bath and a shower and a sleep in the afternoons. And I remember one night I'd been doing an all-nighter for the Cloud Machine that Chris Plummer's double had to come down on, because Chris would appear on stage in a second. And he would have to mime to a speech that was played through a speaker in the back of this big cloud. And it didn't work. And it didn't work because, frankly, the cover for it wasn't actually miming correctly in type. But Sir kept convinced that it was because the speaker wasn't in the right place and it had to be moved. And this had happened on a number of occasions before I got there. And I was now charged with the next move of the speaker overnight, whilst various other things were happening on stage. And we had a fantastic Irish prop lady, prop buyer, who had been around, worked in the film industry a lot. And I was standing by the pass door in the morning with her. It would have been about 7:30 in the morning. And she always had a little hip flask with her. And I was getting very aerated about this, saying, "This is crazy." And Sir was wearing he was wearing one of those neck protectors, big plastic thing, so he couldn't move his...
Oh, right, so a brace.
A brace, of some sort, a yes. Neck brace. Yep. And I was, you know, just letting off steam. And I said, "I know why he wears that fucking thing. It's to stop people like me from strangling him." And as I said that, this hand I felt on my shoulder, and I turned round and it was him. And he'd had a phone call from the office the night before saying that nobody'd heard from me, and was I, or how was everything going? And he, of course, didn't really know who I was. I was just somebody running around doing things. So he'd obviously said to them, I'll go and find him myself and see. And he'd come down to the theatre, and anyway, he took me off for breakfast. And that was the beginning of a very special relationship, really, because I was a baby, I was 21, and he was in his autumn years already, you know.
Oh, that's fantastic, because you hear tales of him being quite a tyrant.
Yeah,
perhaps with other actors.
He had a huge reputation with other actors. And he was, whenever he was with us, he loved to play the technician, and he wasn't a technician, but he loved all of that. So it was very much a performance, and it was a little team together. I never really saw him in those situations where he was dealing with the politics of running the company, which were hard, and... you know, all of the issues of the actor-manager, which is what he was at that time. And he also wasn't well. He was beginning to become unwell. But he was a very gentle soul with me. Only on stage did you really see the power of this man. which was, you know, I mean, his physicality is so hard to describe to people today. I mean, he would work out under the stairs. The housekeeper was called Harry Henderson, and he was a real weightlift fanatic. And Larry would go and sit under the stairs and get into this machine and push all of these homemade weight contraptions that Harry had put together. Yeah, he was amazing to see him on stage. I mean, the power. And then the gentleness of him. I remember almost weeping in Long Day's Journey Into Night, which was the first show I did entirely from the ground up with him. And dear old Michael Blakemore directed. And he did this one sequence, sitting at a table not unlike this, with a table lamp plugged into the light hanging from above. So it's a very small, intimate moment. And he's talking about the windows in this factory high above. And he just took that moment right down that you would hear a pin drop. You know, in what is actually a very rumbustious play of angst and agony, you know. Yeah, he had a huge impact on me. And many of those actors, you know, Tony Hopkins, he again was, you know, quite extraordinary. And a great company of actors, you know, who were not well known to the public at large, but were very well known within, you know, the community. So it was a great time. And there were some, you know, some directors like John Dexter, who, you know, again, was completely different, was a real martinet and ran everything like a military operation. And, you know, and oh, I mean, I could tell you stories about him that, you know, would make your toes curl. Yeah. But a great grounding and made you realise how on it you had to be. You really had to be on it. You know, you couldn't afford to bullshit about anything. So a great grounding, and it came too soon to a close, sadly, with Olivier. I left, and I went off. Well, I went off, not quite know what I was going to do. But then I got a phone call a couple of years later. Well, I actually got a telegram first, and days of telegrams still, which said, "All is forgiven. Come home." And a phone number, and I recognised the phone number. And I rang the annex, and Donald said, "We're moving, we're going to go to the South Bank, it's all going to get built. Come back and join us again." So I did. I went back to the National and worked at the Old Vic.
As production manager?
As production manager, yeah. And, yes, had the last bit with Olivier, which was wonderful. And then Peter Hall arrived and everybody was terrified. The rumours, of course, you can imagine what had happened, you know. But he arrived, and I remember the first show that we had to do with him was Tempest. Gielgud was Blaine Prospero. And Richard and I, you know, we would normally, he was the other production manager, we would alternate in what we were going to do. And he said, "Let's do this one together, because if we fuck it up, we'll both go together." And we were, at that point, the only team that, in advance of him coming in, hadn't been tinkered with. Everybody else had been changed. Literary managers, casting directors, senior stage managers had all been changed. Anyway, we came to do The Tempest, and I mean, it was a massive John Berry production. It was the first time I worked with John. I went on to work with John for many shows after that, who was, you know, came from Joan Littlewood and that whole make and men do, inventing scenery out of bomb rubble in London, you know, fantastically able designer. And we did this show, and the show was a success. Very over the top. I mean, it had everything in it, every special effect that we invented. I can remember throwing throwing liquid nitrogen across the back of the stage, trying to get this effect of sea mist in the air.
Yeah.
And it worked brilliantly. So I dressed some stagehands up in those protective suits,
yes,
with those gloves, and I had carboids of liquid nitrogen, and they were standing at the back throwing it up into the air as the light hit it. And it was completely mad, long, long before the days of health and safety. And I had argon tubes in the mast that would fire this high voltage through the mast, so it looked like St. Elmo's fire creeping up the mast.
Were there many accidents?
No.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Yes, time,
yeah,
before occupation, health and safety,
yeah,
but...
Well, actually, having said that, there was a terrible accident on that show. And Caliban and Prospero played chess at a table on the fourth stage. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Old Vic in those days at all, but it had this very deep fourth stage with a big old pit underneath it. The set had been brought through and the floor of the stage, and we had a thing called the assembly areas, which were renowned at the Old Vic, where actors would enter down through these assembly areas. Well, anyway, this trap had gone down, and John Gielgud, whose birthday it was that day, walked across the trap and it hadn't been locked.
Oh, no.
And he just went straight through. I'm not sure what age he would have been then, but I think it was his 70th birthday. It was a significant birthday. And
Was playing Prospero, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Jackie Harvey, who was the stage manager, was sitting at the production desk. And she just turned to me and she went, "Oh, fuck, I've just killed the first night of the theatre." And we all ran to the front of the stage. And Tommy Connor, who was the prop master, was underneath. He was collecting stuff. And Gielgud had landed on him. And he was lying there going, "It's all right, I'm perfectly fine." Very lucky. Very lucky.
He knew how to fall.
Well, yes, I guess he was so relaxed that he probably, didn't really realise what had happened until he hit Tommy. But, those things happened. Gillian Lynn, again, in Cats, backing off the front of the stage, not Cats, in Phantom, fell into the orchestra pit. And again, how she didn't spike her, she fell into the percussion section, how she didn't spike herself on a hi-hat stand or something, God only knows. And again, she was absolutely perfectly fine. So, accidents do happen, and some of them, of course, we've seen in the years since, have been some horrific, fatal accidents. And so the theatre has always been a dangerous place, and maybe in the early days where we were less adventurous in some of the things that we approached, we were luckier maybe than we should have been. But it is it's a very dangerous place, and one has to be very careful.
So you worked reasonably closely with Laurence Olivier and Peter Hall. What did you learn from them about leading a company?
Well, Larry was all about the company, the actors. And there was an incredible... Because he was a living legend, he was revered in a way. Everybody loved him, and loved really was the word. In fact, I can remember doing another show with him, Eden End, the last J.B. Priestley that they did, and Joan was starring in it.
Clara.
And in fact, Priestley came to rehearsals. I remember meeting Priestley at the rehearsals in the rehearsal room on the Old Vic. And Olivier directed it, and he'd promised me on Amphitryon he'd never direct again. And I can remember him saying to me at the first day of rehearsals, "Yes, sorry about this, dear." Anyway, we were doing this show, and it had to rain. And Dickie Pilbrow, the lighting designer of all time, was lighting the show. He was always Olivier's lighting designer. Came to light it, and it had to rain. It was a view through this living room out into the Dales, and there was a doorway, you could see the back door of the house, and it had to rain outside the back door. And I'd done this absolutely sensational rain effect that rained through the back of the windows, all with these special little hoses. And suddenly, Dickie Pilbrow said, I can't light the set. And every time I get a light near the windows just reflect everybody in the first six rows. So I had to cant all of the windows to obviate the reflection, which was, and again, because we had the 3-weekend production changeovers, I had time to get it back to the workshops and do it. But it completely screwed my rain effect. And I said, I can't, the rain effect doesn't work anymore. It's because the depth was very critical. And Sir Lawrence said to me, I know how to do this. I did this in New York. And I can't remember now what show he did it on, but he sent me out to buy all of these shag pile shower mats. And I went down the cut and bought all these mats, made a frame up. And I thought, this is ludicrous. This isn't going to work. For one reason, it's going to drip and drip. You can't stop it. It's just going to drip. And we're going to hear this noise. And I, of course, had to go through the process because he was determined he knew how to do it and how it would work. And I was up there one day on my own, messing about with this. And he saw me. He came through. And he saw me up there and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to get this effect to work, sir. And he said, come on, I'll get up there with you. So this, you know, mature man starts to climb up this ladder to get up to me. You know, we're about, I don't know, 16 feet up on the back of this set. And the head electrician and a gentleman who became quite a well-known lighting designer himself, Lenny Tucker, came by. And he was a real military man in his, you know, how you behave with people. And he absolutely ripped me off the strip. He said, what are you doing with Sir Lawrence up there? You could get him killed. What do you think's going on? And Sir Lawrence appeased him and said, it's fine, Lenny. Lenny obviously went down to the green room muttering to himself, because within 15 minutes we had an audience of actors and technicians watching this sight of these two people on the top. And I was getting quite embarrassed now. And I said to him, look, sir, this isn't going to work, I'm afraid. And he said, I know, but it's fun, isn't it? And he was playing to the crowd. They were loving it and he was loving it. And he was very good. And he made everybody feel they were part of his family. If he didn't know somebody's name, he'd say, who's the guy over there with the spray on the side? And I'd say, oh, that's Fred. And he'd go over and talk to Fred as though he'd known Fred for 100 years, and how was he today, and how was the family, and, you know, just, it's very...
It's great, but also it's great business acumen as well. If you look after your staff and make them feel valued and appreciated, they're going to go that extra mile.
So that was his sort of focus, whereas Peter was a much more private man. I always say that he was a better politician than he was an artistic director,
right?
Because he never really brought that aspect of himself to the company in a public way. Now, I know that he was very good with artists. I did No Man's Land with him. And for him to get Ralph and John to play together in those parts was an accomplishment in itself, particularly when looked at the material and what does this really mean and what were the relationships potentially. So, you know, he was obviously a very talented man and very determined. I mean, to have, you know, co-founded the Royal Shakespeare Company with Barton, to have then come on the work that he did at Glyndebourne. I mean, look, he even ended up being the artistic director of Glyndebourne whilst he was at the National Theatre. I mean, unheard of, and raised many an eyebrow with us at the National. But he was able to push those things through. And it was a very difficult building to open. We had huge problems opening it. And the issues that he were dealing with, you know, were way beyond my understanding, I'm sure, at that time. I can remember just struggling to physically get the building open. It was a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. And a lot of people were wrecked in the process of doing so. But, you know, you always work to your leader, whoever it was. You can easily look back and say this was wrong or that was wrong, but at the time you get on with the job because the most important thing is the show, and the show has to open, and you said it's going to open at that time on that day. So he, you know, he conjured a spirit that was very different from Olivier's, but people, you know, loved him and wanted to work for him. And it became a very big company too, because, you know, when we were at the Old Vic, the National Theatre was maybe 120 people. Mm. When we went to the South Bank, it was 400 people. It was massive. Yeah, it was massive.
So I think you had 7 years at the National.
Yes.
And then you left and started the production office.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I'd had a... It all happened because I had a fight with Peter. I was about to take No Man's Land to Canada in advance of it opening on Broadway. And we had this strike, what was known in the British press as the National Theatre's plumber strike. And it was being used at that time as a ruse to just screw the management for all sorts of union issues. We had never resolved the house contract moving from the Old Vic to the National. And I had always argued that that had to be thrown away and we had to start fresh. And they wouldn't do that. And there were all sorts of reasons. I won't go into it now, but I ended up having a row with Victor Mishkon and Peter at a meeting that we were having, a sort of crisis meeting during these whole rolling strike problems. And I remember Victor Mishkon saying, the National Theatre is a shop window, we have to present the best face. And I'm going, but no, we have to fix, you know, the foundations first before we worry about the shop window. And I was, you know, look, I was a relatively junior person within the hierarchy there. I was a production manager, technical director, and I thought, well, I just can't abide this. And I had done a Moonlight, funnily enough, earlier. I'd had a phone call maybe a year before that the stage door put through, and I remember it to this day. The stage door ran and said, I've got this lady on the phone called Helen Montague, who needs to speak to you. And I said, Helen Montague, I don't know that. I don't know that name. Anyway, I took the phone call and this lady said to me, hello, my name's Helen Montague. Franco Zeffirelli says I have to employ you. And I went, oh, yes, what's...
Had I'm you sorry, worked with Zeffirelli? Or did...
Yes, I had
there, worked. So there was a relationship, right?
Yeah, no, I had worked with Zeffirelli. And so I met her and I realised, and of course she was a... probably the most important female producer ever to be produced to this date, and an Australian to boot.
She bought 42nd Street out here.
She did, yeah. Yes, in her more autumnal period. But she was a very important part of British theatre. She was at the Royal Court in those early days. You know, she was having all of those conversations with the new writers. She was, I mean, you could... do hours and hours on Helen. She was an amazing woman. Anyway, she was now running. I don't know whether she was still running Tenants or whether she'd set up her own backstage productions. But anyway, I got inveigled into doing this show for Franco, which was with Joni again and another very well known actor at the time called Colin Blakely, and it was Philomena. And I took that round the traps and then brought it into the West End for her. And she said, I've got loads of things. I'm going to do a new piece with Hayley Mills and this, and I want you to do, you know. And I said, well, I'm still at the National. I'm not sure that I can do that, but thank you. And then I got a phone call from a designer that I'd worked with and got my real battle scars on with a show called... Tales of Vienna Woods, Adam von Horvath. And it was massive. We had a very famous reviewer in England at that time who sneeringly said not only, you know, is this show a remarkable production, but you can finally see the Olivier Revolve turning, which had famously not turned since the building opened.
Because they couldn't get the mechanics to work?
And it wasn't. I had built this temporary Revolve, which was actually much bigger than the Revolve in the stage, powered by two stagehands sitting on upturned racing bikes, pedalling it round. because we couldn't do it with the motor because there were just too many deads. It had to go to so many positions, and it had a set on it that moved, so it created these wonderful optical illusions. But it was a nightmare to do. And I'd also done another show with them, John Gabriel Borkman with Wendy Hiller and Rafe Richardson, which again was a nightmare to do. And they had now been engaged by Hal Prince to do a show called Evita. And they rang me and said, would I go and do Evita for them in the West End? And I said, well, I'm at the National. I'm not sure I can do that. Anyway, it was a big project. So I'd arranged with the National that I would have a 3 to 6 month sabbatical. And my assistant would cover for me. I would prep everything. And that was the one good thing, you knew what you were going to be doing. And this was the year before. Anyway, the plumber strike happened, and I decided that was it, and I sort of spat the dummy. And I thought, I'm just going to go, and I'll do this show, and maybe Helen will have some more shows. And that was what happened. And I was able to persuade Richard, who was pretty disenchanted with politically what was happening at the National at that point, to come with me, and that, you know, something would happen, we'd get something together. And to cut a long story, that is what happened. I mean, we still had problems at the National. A lot of people resigned when we resigned, so we were accused of blackmailing the National at that point. I remember Christopher Morahan came to see me saying, why are you doing this? Why are you undermining the revenue? I said, we're not doing anything to anybody. But anyway, that all got eased out, and we then eventually left, and I did Evita. And Helen did come back with another show, Clifford Williams and Dracula, with, never guess who played the lead in this, George Chakiris.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
And Mickey Feast, who'd played Ariel in The Tempest, was in it. There was an amazing, amazing crew of people. But it was a nightmare show to do. And Michael White was putting...
Another Australian.
Another version of Dracula on with Frank Langella.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And so this became a sort of competition. And I remember going to Helen one day saying that we're going terribly over budget. I had these very fancy spreadsheets that I had, you know, printed at the National. Of course, no computers then, everything done by hand. And I said, Helen, we're over budget, and, you know, Clifford is not really on top of his game. And we're just making more and more special effects to cover up the defects in the show. And she looked at me, leant down, picked up her handbag and opened it and pulled out her checkbook and leant over to me, and she said, darling, this is the budget.
How much do you need?
And I never worked with her again.
Right.
I left. I walked off. I never did another show with her again, which is very... Well, I don't know. She was a force of nature, Helen. But funnily enough, wind forward, I don't know how many years, 15 years, and Helen came into my life privately and became a very best friend.
What was it like being on the ground floor of a musical like Evita? Because...
Oh, terrifying.
Terrifying, yeah.
I didn't know whether to sit on the toilet or throw up.
Right.
I used to go home and be sick. The pressure of getting that show on. And, of course, I'd gone from, you know, basically a fantastic internal system to the West End, which had nothing. Production manager didn't exist still.
So you're creating your own job description.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And... it was a ride, but it worked, thank heavens. And Hal was very appreciative, and he was a terror too, because I used to say Hal doesn't actually direct shows, he auditions them. Because he'd just say, show me this, show me that. And then he'd pick what he liked. Or he'd say, no, you stop doing that, but you continue to. I mean, it was quite funny. Hal, of course, was a stage manager in his past.
Yes, originally. Yeah.
And that's what really became clear to me, was that he was actually stage managing the show. But he could never say up front what he really needed. He wanted it to do everything. And the original design for Evita did everything. It was a magic box, and things popped in on trucks and so forth. All of that got flayed away during the process of the technicals.
And became that very bare-bones Brechtian sort of...
Yeah, and the person who really delivered that show at that time in many, many ways was Larry Fuller, the choreographer, who was unbelievably talented within that genre of work and sadly didn't have a huge career, obviously to me anyway, after that. But yeah, he did... And the way he moved the crowds around.
Yes, that staging is very dance oriented,
and has been ripped off by people as original ideas many times in the years since. And of course, we had some fantastic people. You know, Elaine, Joss Ackland playing Perron, who was a force, and dear old
David Essex,
mm. who was just such a lovable chap. And, I mean, he would always arrive slightly surprised that he was in this world and doing it, you know? It was quite extraordinary.
And it wasn't received well by the critics at first, was it?
No, well, I don't think any of the shows I've ever done have been that well received by the critics. But again, the public loved it. It caught the mood of the moment. It had a scale about it in a modern sense that hadn't been seen. Before that, superstar, but in a different way, and some fantastic music and Tim's lyrics. I mean, you know, when he nobody can touch him when he's on song. It's just amazing. So yeah, it became a powerhouse really, and moved very quickly. And then of course it came out here. It wasn't long before. I was talking to dear old John Robertson about it coming out to Adelaide, and then I took it to America, and it opened actually on the West Coast first, and then went to Broadway. That was very valuable for me, because people realised how technically complex that show was for its time. It had four follow spots, which was unheard of at that time, two out front, two on stage. A rake floor, which is very controversial with equity. It was a 1 in 16 rake, and there was huge stresses about people dancing on a rake floor like that, you know, 8 shows a week. It had the film content, which was complex to do at that time, the whole issues of would it catch fire?
Yes.
I mean, simple things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember having terrible trouble with the... London County Council ran the theatres in those days, and the District Surveyors Department would come in with the fire brigade, and, you know, you'd be, like, under factory conditions. It was quite tricky. And, in fact, it was really then that I fell in love with that theatre, and I thought... Because it wasn't a theatre before we went in there. There'd been one piece in there. It was the Cinerama, home of Cinerama in London.
Right.
And then before that, it was a Forces Club. And I'd always thought, oh, gosh... If you could get your hands on this, it'd make quite an interesting theatre. And not long later, Robert Stigwood said to me, you know...
Another Australian.
Yes, another Australian. I haven't thought of that before. What about buying the palace? And Prince Lintler was thinking of selling it at that point. And I said, oh, no, let's buy the Prince Edward. And he went, oh, no, no, dear. So that boat passed, but I'd always kept a place for that. I thought it was very underrated, and then it had a very checkered career after Evita had been in there. But yeah, that was a major plank for me, and then having done the other bits for Helen, and then other producers would approach us. Did Bar Mitzvah Boy with Don Black, various productions of Fiddler and, you know, those kind of things.
So when did Cats creep into your lap?
Cats came again because of another National Theatre person, actually, John Napier. And we'd done, I'd done Equus with John at the National. And he'd worked in the West End doing a Doctor Who, a Dalek show.
A stage show?
Yes, right. Which had not gone terribly well, but needed some help, and we helped. And he would often come and have coffee with us. People would drop into our office in town just to have a cup of coffee, because the first time ever there was a place where creative, technical people could meet. And,
could gather.
Yeah. And we had our own team. We had our own carpentry team, our own electric sound. I was still very keen on lighting and sound and those things, and was very keen to make space for those people. And we had a lighting office, and I had a sound company, and, you know, all very Mickey Mouse, but all in the right spirit, all trying to give these people a chance to build real careers. And John came one day and he said, look, I'm doing this show, it's called Cats. And we all, of course, fell about. It's like, it's called Cats. So we can't do it. We're busy doing dogs. And these jokes rolled around for ages. And one day he came and he said, I've got to get you on this show. They don't know what they're doing. And he said, I'm going to get you to do all of the public areas. And Richard and I looked at each other. And
what do you mean by public areas?
Well, the front of house? All the audience, front of house stuff.
Yes, right.
And we said, but John, you can't split a show like that with a theatre that is all in the public area. There's no proscenium. And he said, well, you know that, and I know that, but they don't, and you'll just get the whole show. It'll just automatically come to you. So that's what we did. And I was busy, actually, redesigning Jesus Christ Superstar to go on tour. And that was quite a big job, because it was like this permanent installation. You had to take dynamite to get it out of the theatre at the Palace. It was fluorescent tubes with ballast units that must have weighed tons and tons and tons under the stage, and all this complicated lighting of the floor. So we were going to do a tour of it. Well, how do you move something like that and retain all of the essence of the original design? So I'd focused on this for a long time, and it was decided that Richard would be the lead on Cats and I would come in and help here and there. So that's the way it went. And they got into a real pickle with Cats. The show did its first preview without having done a dress rehearsal for the second act. And I'd gone down to see them a number of times with the set, which was still, you know, because of what they were trying to do, it was being invented sort of as it went along. And so I was sort of known a bit, but not, you know, I wasn't in the middle of it like Richard was. Anyway, the show opened, it became this huge success. And about 6 weeks later, the office rang over, and we were literally diagonally opposite each other. Cameron was in the top floor of the Fortune Theatre, and I was at 49 Wellington Street in Covent Garden. So it was literally either side of this crossroads. And we went out the door, walked over to see him, and he said, I want you to sort my company out.
You'd obviously made an impression on Cats.
Yes, I suppose so. And we looked at each other and said, all right, let us think about this. So we went away, and Richard said, look, you do that, I don't do that. Richard didn't like anything that wasn't about building sets.
He was very hands-on.
He was very hands-on and very organized. I mean, a great strategist and all of that, but he didn't like all that stuff.
The politics.
Yeah, the politics. And, you know,
the people business.
The people business in that way, yeah. And so I did it. And I did it by putting on My Fair Lady with Alan J. Lerner directing it. Because I thought the only way to really learn how a company works is to actually do something in it. And so Cameron said, well, do this. Nobody else is paying attention to it. And, I mean, it was real suitcase job. I worked on that, and I came out of that, and I realised that actually, I won't go into the detail, but Cameron had done a number of things to simplify and retain control of his company that had actually diminished his ability to actually do things. And so I handed a report in after, I can't remember how many weeks, and he hated it. And I had made all sorts of recommendations, saying, you need to do this, you need to get somebody who can do that. And I went back to Richard and I said, well, that's that. I said, I'm sorry, I've not only fucked up the consultancy, but it's unlikely that we'll ever get another show from him. And we laughed about it and said, you know, it's all right, we've got lots of other things to do. And we were suddenly sort of doing lots of things. And we do tiny little plays. We weren't just doing big, you know, we were doing wonderful, you know, plays with Judy Dench and, you know, all sorts of people. So another month or so went by, and then the phone rang again, and it was Cameron saying, I'd like you to come over and speak to me.
he'd had time to think.
He'd had time to think, so I went over and spoke to him. And he said, look, I really don't like all of this. I don't want to do that, but I want you to come and do it. And I said, pardon. He said, you know what to do. You just come and do it. And I said, but I've got my own business. He said, well, you can run that. And I said, well, yes, but, you know, I have an ability here to manipulate. He said, it doesn't matter what. You just do what you want. You do it the way you think it should be. And if you're not sure about something, just ask me. And at this point, Cameron was travelling quite a lot. You know, he was coming out here to Australia because...
Well, like his Cats was exploding too.
Well, no, not
no,
then.
No, not then, right?
No, but he was coming out doing Oklahoma. Little Shop came out here. I think Fair Lady. He was doing productions of... I think it was Tomfoolery.
Yes, The Review.
So he was dodging about a lot. And, of course, I was just dropped into something very intense. I didn't really see the bigger picture at that point. But I started to work on all these bits and pieces. And, of course, I loved it. And it became consuming. It wasn't something that I could do with the production office. But I agreed that the production office would do all of the shows that... Richard could run the company, and I would go off and do this because I really did want to produce, and this was a great opportunity.
So your role now became more of a producing role?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say probably managing role at that point, because I was trying to make everything work. There was a lot of history to sort out, which needed addressing. And so there's a lot of housekeeping to do. But within that, there were all of these shows bouncing around. And, you know, Cats was a pretty full-time operation at that point, managing that. And that we did put a resident team into. So we had every area covered so that the creatives were represented all the time. We had resident director, choreographer.
At that time, did you realise that it was going to be literally now and forever?
No. Nobody knew really what that meant. But it was incredibly powerful as, you know, the advance increased. And then the interest came for America, and Schubert's were licensed it with Cameron and Andrew. And Cameron had done work there before. There had been plans... to, you know, he was obviously had an eye to America and the opportunities that, you know, would happen there. And I was very leery about it because when I'd done Evita, I didn't really like the way it worked. It was very clear that the producers were not well represented from a managerial point of view on the technical side of things, that there were a lot of done deals, often between producers and the workshops.
So various contractors.
Yes. Yeah. The contractors called the shots. They would decide who the crews would be. In those days, most of the people working in the shops were in Local One operating the show at night. So they'd be on the bench in the day and they'd be in the theatre at night.
Right.
It was very much a father to son. It made the unionisation in the UK look very lame by comparison. And it was, you know, the Teamsters as well, all of that. Very tough. And I'd had a bit of an experience of that in Canada because I've always been very hands-on and you're not allowed to be. And I got so shouted at in Canada that they made me an honorary member of IATSE because they couldn't stop me climbing up a ladder to do things. So they did take all of that stuff quite seriously. And I didn't like this sort of closed shop mentality. And again, it was a very formative stage. You know, it wasn't as we know it today. There was no such thing as a production manager on Broadway. So Cats happened and again was a huge success on Broadway, and we were then planning. Oliver was just about to be done, which was a disaster. It closed in a month, which again had been licensed. And then Song and Dance, which Cameron did using the general managers that the Schuberts used, Tyler Gatchell, Gatchell and Neufeld. And they were lovely, but never quite did what Cameron wanted. And I said to him, look, it won't work here like this. I said, the only way it will work is if we do this ourselves, because we're the ones who know what we want. And that means putting in a much bigger commitment to it. Because historically, all shows were just licensed around the world and nobody really knew how they were put together. And nobody really cared. As long as they got their check, you know, there wasn't a huge concern about this detail or that detail. Well, we were, you know, pains in the arse about detail. So after we did Song and Dance, Cameron threw the towel in and said, you're right, what do you think? And I said, we just need to set our own office up and we'll do it. We'll create it ourselves. So he said, all right, let's think about that. And he had a very dear friend who was, Albert Poland was the queen of Off-Broadway. I mean, Albert, you find Albert is mentioned every other word if you look at the history of Off-Broadway. And he gave us a little room. We'd always camped in his space and shared his secretary, who in fact became our secretary in the end. And that's sort of how we started to get a foothold there. And it really blossomed with Les Miserables, because when Les Miserables opened, and again to poor reviews, and we hadn't even spent the last third of the capital in transferring it, Roger Stevens from the Kennedy Center, I'm sort of slightly collapsing things here, but Roger Stevens from the Kennedy Center, who again was a legend man, you know, appointed by Kennedy to open and run the place, a real mensch. And he arrived and wanted to do it. He thought it was a wonderful show and it would be great at the Kennedy Center. And that gave us our foothold to then think, well, we could do the Kennedy Center and then take it in. And he became a partner in that. And he introduced us to his general manager of the Kennedy Center, who was general managing the Kennedy Center whilst also being a Broadway general manager, who became my lifelong bosom buddy, a man called Alan Wasser. And Alan had been general managing shows like Sugar Babies, and he'd done all of those. And he arrived and we just hit it off. And he basically, again, to cut a long story short, became our general manager and our office and did nothing else for, I don't know, 15 years. And that was really how I was able to establish the American office. And then, of course, I said, well, we're not going to build shows like this anymore. And I want to meet the crew. It became a big joke on Broadway that not only did the artists have to audition, but the crew had to audition. it was very funny. But I had some fabulous people. And some of them were terrified too. They were told not to work for us one boy, now a mature man many years later, but was beaten up for saying he was going to come and work for us, and he didn't. He eventually came and worked for me on Saigon many years later and is now a brilliant automation carpenter and manager and does a lot of fantastic things around the place. Some people were very intimidated to come and work for us because we were breaking all the rules. The shop decide this and that, and no. I had a production manager. The production manager would have an assistant. They would have a department. They would all work with the electricians, the carpenters. They were, you know. And I had some great old-timers who said, yeah, it's time for a change, you know, and came and got involved. So that it was a big change. The Australian wing was next, really, because Cameron kept going to Australia and I didn't go until we opened CATS. And I'd been always rather curious as to why we weren't doing anything in Europe, and I knew that Cameron had lost a lot of money doing a show in Europe, and it was one of the things I had to sort out. And so he didn't want to know about Europe, Germany, France, you know, whatever. And I was always a bit curious about that. And then when I went to Australia and I met, you know, the team that were working out of the Theatre Royal with Freddie Gibson, dear Freddie. I went back to Australia for the first birthday of CATS in Melbourne. It had left Sydney, gone to Melbourne. And there were huge union problems in Melbourne. And Adelaide were the managers of the show.
Adelaide Festival.
Adelaide Festival. Yep. They produced and managed the show. And, not to put too fine a point on it, the crew were being paid money each week not to go on strike.
On top of their wages.
And I was beside myself. And everybody said, oh, you've got to be very careful. It's very tough here and they'll take you down the shed. And I laughed. I said, what does that mean, take you down the shed? Anyway, I said, oh, look, we have to address this. And so I had a meeting with the union people. And they said, well, they've got to be paid properly because they've got permanent jobs now and they can't go off and do their, you know, other casual work.
Freelancing, yeah.
I said, gosh, that's dreadful. I had no idea that's what we were doing. Look, I release everybody from their contract now. They can go in 2 weeks. And I could see the shop steward shuffle a bit. And the guy said, what? I said, look, if we're restricting your members' ability to get work, then obviously we'll release them from their contracts. And there was this icy moment. And I'm sure Robbo thought somebody was going to get up and punch me. But the whole thing just dissolved. Well, no, we should talk more about... And that was really the beginning of things like joint bargaining agreements and all the award systems that happened and our ability to negotiate with individuals and not directly with the union. And that was really the beginning of Australia, you know, in terms of all those shows.
CATS and Les Mis and Phantom. And I mean, they have taken over the world. You know, there's been productions in almost every continent. How much does something like marketing and good management come into play there for the breadth of success that they've had?
Well, obviously it's very important, but it's not what we did. And I remember this first came up with Germany because CATS going to Germany wasn't going to happen. And I got a phone call one day from Andrew's office. His accountant had somebody who'd arrived to talk to him from Germany about putting CATS on. And I said, but you own the rights. We don't own the rights. We're partners, but you drive the bus on these kind of issues. And he said, yes, but nobody will talk to him here. So I said, well, look, send him over. I'm happy to talk to him. And he said, would you come and produce CATS in Germany for us? And I went, oh, wonderful. I said, I'd love to, but we can't actually produce it. I will teach you how to produce it, and we will put the team together, but you have to finance it, and most importantly, you have to sell it, because I don't know your market. And that's the most important thing, is to know your market. And I went to Cameron and Andrew and said, you know, and you can imagine the reaction, what, we're never going back to Germany, you know, all this. And I said, no, wait a minute, we're not at risk, but I, you know, I've been banging the drum about this. I believe there's a real opportunity here. And, yeah, we, in 85, we opened it in Germany, in Hamburg. And that was basically taken on to other places. Japan was another huge, that was hard. And we had to set up our own drama school in Japan to teach people to sing and act in a Western way, because musical phrasing is completely different, you know, in Japanese and Chinese and so forth.
The show would be sung in the language of the the country it was.
Well, that
being
was the one
in.
Thing that we did that I think, you know, regardless of your view of the material itself, what made it special was the fact that we allowed every country to make it their own. So we were there saying this is how it should be put together. But in terms of the heart and spirit that you give it, then those artists would bring that, the best possible people or the most appropriate people to doing the translation were engaged, and we were lucky. We had the BBC Foreign Unit working with us, helping us assess translations. You know, should this be a poet who does this show, or should this be a literary person? Or, and that was, you know, that was done very, very carefully. You know, through, I mean, I can't remember in my time, 27, 37 countries, you know, 35 languages, whatever it was. I wasn't that closely involved in the management of the merchandising for Cats, but I was for Les Miserables, and we set up our own operation, in fact, for it. It wasn't farmed out, and Les Miserables was extraordinary. And you still see shirts around now, and you still see Cat shirts around now, of course. But yeah, that became pretty significant. But I think one of the more significant things was just the word of mouth. That the, you know, this was, it's very difficult to appreciate the context today because there's too much on everywhere all the time. In those days, there wasn't that much on. We were the only people, who just did musical theatre. We didn't do plays. We only did musicals. Nobody else did musicals. And it wasn't until Les Mis had hit, Phantom had just opened, that people realised that actually these shows can become really serious business machines. And for me, that was the death of it, because that then attracted corporate world to theatre. Because suddenly it became as important financially as film. I mean, Phantom grossed more than Titanic, you know.
It's extraordinary. What about those, I've never was lucky enough to go to one, but those opening night parties, Phantom of the Opera at the Regent Theatre in Melbourne.
Yes,
Before it was restored, I think, wasn't it? So
it was. That was a funny story. The parties became, by accident, they became something that became as notorious as the shows, really. But it happened initially with Les Mis, because it was our first show on Broadway, and I was very keen we did something special. And the parties were usually, you know, canapes and a drink at Sardi's, which was lovely, but I wanted to do something different. And I said to Cameron, you know, can we do something that's a bit special for this? And I spoke to what is now my oldest friend in America, and I'm actually just going to go and visit shortly, who had worked in the corporate world and had done a lot of hospitality in the corporate world. And I was a bit cheeky with him. I went to dinner with him one night down at Peter's on Second Avenue and said, Jimmy, can you think of somebody who could maybe give me a hand? I've got this idea for an opening night party. And just as we drank more and talked more, I just could see I was reeling him in. And he did that party and every party, and continues to do parties. And we did it at the Armory, which is this amazing old building on the Upper West Side. And it was extraordinary. I mean, we built campaign tents. It's where they used to parade internally, training troops. It goes back, 150 years. And the other thing that it had was it had a loft for homeless people. And it was a great opportunity for us to draw attention to New York's homelessness, which was terrible at that time. And it got cleaned up by just removing people. But at that time, everything was out in the street to see. And New York was still quite rough. I mean, it wasn't like the end of the 70s and early 80s where policemen were still getting shot on the subway, but it was, you were careful where you went. And anyway, we did this party there, and then we arranged for all of this food to feed everybody at homelessness, and got this attention onto this subject. So a lot of the party side of things we had a serious side to as well, that allowed us to draw attention to certain things. A lot with Saigon as well, with the Bui Doi and all of that, which was, now is all gone, but in those days, when we opened Saigon, the Bui Doi were still only 15 or 16 years old, so it was still very real. So, yes, it set off a train of events for parties that, we took everywhere and it came here. And it happened at the Regent, funnily enough, because I discovered the theatre was an old cinema, but it had closed. I'd gone back to look at it, having seen it before, and couldn't get in because it was all closed up and derelict. And we'd had a great party in the gardens at Parliament House before, and I said, look, this would be a great place to do this. It's Lon Chaneyville, we can put the film on. And anyway, we weren't allowed to use it. And Joan Kerner, who was a very troubled premier at that time, and was very keen on us because she gave this speech about Phantom being this, Phantom-led recovery of Melbourne. She said, there's nothing I can do. The only person who can give you permission is the Commissioner of Police. And so I had to toddle off and see him. And as I was going in, there were these gentlemen from the fire brigade coming out with holding stacks of videos that had obviously been showing horrors of, public burnings. And he said, look, it's a very difficult situation. I know what you want to do. It's a good intention, draw attention to the building, blah, blah. But the fire brigade are really concerned. If there's a fire, there'd be a disaster. And all I can say is that, if you were to do it, you'd have to have fire tender and staff there, and that's expensive. And I said, that's completely understandable. Could we have six? And he said, what? I said, we'd have six tenders and, as many people who want to work that night. I even thought it'd be nice to have a fireman as a table decoration on each of the tables. And he laughed and he said, look, it's not funny, but you will have to. And I said, no, I'm really happy to pay and be happy to have as many tenders as we can get round the building. And we got permission.
Wow.
No smoking party, although there was an alleyway. There's some famous photographs of well-known actors in the alleyway in black tie or white tie, smoking a cigarette. And we decked out the auditorium, covered all the old dilapidated chairs that were in there and put tables and chairs in. And the stage was stripped, just bare walls, black dance floor with the Phantom logo on it and the silent movie of Lon Chaney playing on the back wall. And dear old Roger Barrett, who so sadly is no longer with us, lit it beautifully for us. He used to laugh, said, I have more trouble lighting your parties than I do any shows, but it looked fantastic. And it did draw attention. And David Mariner, who we'd been working with, you know, saw that, you know, something was going to happen here, and he would get in there, and he did, which was great.
Do you have a favourite musical?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, Les Mis immediately comes to mind, just because of, you know, it was an extraordinary piece of work with a team of people that I grew up with, in a way, you know, long before just commercial theatre. And Evita, because it was a milestone for me. It was just a magical moment to get that show. I remember listening to the album and thinking, I can't believe I'm going to work on this. And to work with Hal, who became a lifelong, you know, friend, and worked with again, you know, very unusual that happens like that. And Long Day's Journey Into Night is a special show for me with Olivier, because it was the crowning, really, of a fairly long association with him. But there's so many, and every one is special because they're all a family. You know, they all have their moments. Yeah.
Are you still hungry for the next project?
If I'm really honest, no. Only because I've changed, I think. I moved to Australia, and I discovered the natural world in a way that I hadn't recognised since I was a small child, because I grew up in the country. And I realised how special it was, and that I was fortunate enough to take the time to enjoy it. So that's what I do now, really. I mean, I'm still, you know, engaged with it. Not really here, if I'm honest, but I'm still very engaged in London, and I, you know, talk to friends and help friends who have projects that, you know, they need help with, and occasionally in America. And that's enough for me, really.